Yeah, thank you so much. And it is nighttime for me.
Yeah.
I'm in Barre, Massachusetts. And I'm delighted. I do feel very strongly connected to the community in Seattle and the place. And it has been a long time since I've been there, but this is a way of being there, which makes me very happy. And who knows what the future will bring. I am in Barre, Massachusetts right now. I have a house here that's just through the woods from the Insight Meditation Society, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary in February. We moved in almost 50 years ago on Valentine's Day, which is every time I say something like that, I feel ridiculous. Like, how could that possibly be true? I was with a group of people, in New York City the other day, and I was saying that I had a conversation with Will Kabat-Zinn on Zoom, and Will was talking about his grandfather, who was Howard Zinn, famous historian, and his grandfather was about 92. And he asked, I guess the conversation moved to, I think he actually directly asked his grandfather, "How old do you feel? How old do you feel inside?" And Howard Zinn said, "As long as I'm not moving, I feel like I'm in my 20s. You know, but once the body gets involved, of course, then another kind of reality sets in. But, you know, when I think IMS is turning 50, I think I'm not even 50, which of course I am well over it. But nonetheless, you know, time is such an interesting, mysterious factor." So, that is an incredible moment for us to commemorate, like 50 years. So I'm sure you'll all be hearing about the kinds of programs we'll be offering. And for tonight, you know, I'm so glad we have the chance just to have a discussion. I'm going to speak first a little bit. Maybe we'll have a chance for another shorter meditation together, and certainly a way of hearing from you, or several ways of hearing from you. And I thought I would talk about, to start off with, this concept in the Buddhist teaching of the middle way or the middle path, which has like a very familiar, almost conventional understanding, and also has another understanding which isn't talked about so much. So the familiar way it's often described is replicated in the legend of the Buddha's life. And you can feel if any of this is relevant to your life, right? So for the first 29 years of the Buddha's life, he lived a life of just complete sensory overindulgence. They say, and remember, this is all legend or myth, they say that when he was born, he was first born, his father called in two different astrologers to make a prediction for the life of the baby. And the first astrologer held up two fingers and said, there are two ways his life can go. It'll go in one of these two ways. The first way is that he'll stay in the world with worldly pursuits. He'll become a world-reigning monarch with incredible power and riches. And the second way could be that he becomes a mendicant. He kind of leaves worldly concerns behind, becomes fully enlightened, becomes a Buddha. So the second astrologer apparently was a little more with it, and he held up one finger and he said he's going to become a Buddha. But the father did not like that. He wanted his son to have that kind of power and riches and stay in the world. So as the legend goes, they say that his father knew that seeing suffering in life was a goad to questioning more deeply. And the last thing he wanted his son to do was question more deeply. So he tried to spare him any sight of suffering. in life. And, you know, they say things like he had a team of gardeners to go out in the middle of the night and pluck out any withering blossoms or something so his son should not be displeased by anything. And this lasted in kind of a riotous self-indulgence until the Buddha, then known as the Bodhisattva, or being aspiring to enlightenment, was 29. And at 29, remember, this is all like myth, he left the palace grounds with a charioteer. And when he left, he came upon seeing a sick person, an older person, a corpse, and a mendicant, someone who had left the world behind to seek a deeper truth. And these are known as the four heavenly messengers. And each time with the first three, the Bodhisattva would ask the charioteer, like seeing an older person, seeing a sick person, is that going to happen to me? Does it happen to everyone? And the charioteer said, yes. So seeing the mendicant was his inspiration to kind of leave home and seek a deeper truth. So he spent those 29 years in complete self-indulgence, looking for happiness in all of those places of, you know, endless pleasure and comfort and so on. And then they say the Bodhisattva spent the next 6 years in kind of extreme self-mortification, like over asceticism. It was common in certain schools, certain philosophical schools in India of the time, to feel that if you tortured your body enough, your spirit would soar free and you could become enlightened. There were people, you know, this is where we have the kind of image of people lying on beds of nails and stuff. But there were people known as the bovine ascetics and the canine ascetics who went around for all their lives imitating cows and dogs and in a way trying to humiliate the body in order to become free. Now, I really do think we can often see ourselves in some of these extremes. Certainly, there are so many cultural messages we get that if we accumulate enough, if we have enough stuff, if we have enough experiences, we'll be safe. We'll be safe from change, sometimes even safe from death in our minds. That we have to experience only pleasure all the time, and that something is wrong if we're hurting. Something is wrong with us if we're hurting, if we're frightened, things aren't going so well. That sort of mirrors those first 29 years of the Bodhisattva's life, the Buddha's life. And these days, it may be more common to have that feeling of self-mortification mentally, emotionally, psychologically. And not many of us are lying on beds of nails, although there can be a lot of abuse of one's body. But I think of, you know, the sort of corrosive power of self-judgment and self-hatred, feeling like that's a path, you know. If I can only condemn some of these emotions enough, I'll be free. I won't have to feel them. If I can only put myself down enough, that's real humility. And that will liberate me. So there's kind of a parallel, even though not exactly precise. So after 29 years of indulgence, 6 years of self-mortification, the Bodhisattva woke up one day and said, that's not the way either. And that was the sort of, you could say, the dawning of the idea of the middle way or the middle path, which I used to really misunderstand. It seemed to me for a long time that it was like, take a little bit of self-indulgence and a little bit of self-mortification, mix them together, you've got the middle. But it's not like that at all. It's about avoiding each extreme. And the efforts that we make, the movements that we make toward growth, toward understanding, are coming from a whole different place than either the delusion of self-indulgence or self-mortification. They're coming from a basis of awareness and compassion and so on. And so that's the fire, the Bodhisattva, still known as the Bodhisattva at that time, came upon this thought of the middle way. And as you know, I'm sure, in the very common legend, he wandered over, he ate for the first time. He hadn't eaten in a long time, you know, because that was part of his ascetic tradition. He ate milk rice, known as kheer. If you ever go to an Indian restaurant, I always order the kheer just in hopes that, you know, I'll get enlightened that night too. And he went and sat under a tree and practiced in the middle way, not grabbing onto experience, thinking it's going to completely fulfill him, not hating himself and punishing himself anymore. And they say, you know, as legend goes, he was enlightened at dawn of the arising of the first morning star. So that's how the middle way is normally talked about. And there's also a way in which it's talked about, which I find interesting as well, which is around extreme views. You know, there's so much of our personal suffering and sense of limitation is born out of falling one of these two extreme views about reality. In one view, we feel there must be something that's secure or substantial that we can hold on to, we can keep, that is going to make us okay, finally, forever. There must be something lasting that we can see or hear or touch or hold. And if we have that view, everything matters a lot, because we have a continual hope that somewhere there's perfect security, there's unchanging happiness, and we continually seek it only to be disappointed. So when we're lost in that view, that extreme, we grasp and we cling to experiences really in a world of change. And so, of course, we suffer. I don't know if you can see it with my camera on blur, but during the pandemic, the height of the pandemic, I should say, when I was teaching an extraordinary amount on Zoom, apparently I was saying the same thing over and over again. And people started sending me mugs with different of those sayings on it. So this one, which apparently I said a lot, says, banging your head against the wall is never fun. And that's really embodied in that kind of extreme view. We just, why we do that? You know, you think we would have learned it's not going to last. Appreciate it while you have it. Clinging is not going to help. But we do it over and over again. The other extreme view, I think, is very interesting to explore, especially in our time. And that would be the opposite. Rather than everything matters so much, it's like nothing matters. Everything is kind of void or blank, and we live in a world of random, hopeless chaos. It's a completely nihilistic view. Putting it in Buddhist terminology, it would be the view that says, since everything is empty and insubstantial, what difference does anything make? Why do anything? Why care? Why try to help anybody? It's all empty. And so if we're lost in that view, we fall into apathy and disconnection, and also we suffer. So the middle way in Buddhist teaching is said to avoid both these extreme views. Things are not inherently permanent, you know, designed to give us endless, unchanging satisfaction, nor is that kind of emptiness or changing nature the sole expression of reality. Our lives actually rest in that very delicate place where everything is arising and changing. It's all happening, and we can't cling to anything. Reality is, it's full, it's vital, and it's also insubstantial. It's fleeting, it's evanescent. what becomes crucial to understand is that even though everything that arises is kind of shimmering and moving and changing, it's also consequential. Experiences are happening, even if they don't last. It's important to understand that actions have consequences. And because it's so hard to describe this in words, the Buddha often used images to describe this nature of reality. He said that life is like a rainbow, like an echo, like a dream. Life is like a drop of dew on a blade of grass, like a flash of lightning in a summer sky. That's true. And yet you look at a rainbow, it's not blank, right? It's full on, all those different colors. And those are born by intentionality, where we put our energy, what we care about, our actions. Everything may be insubstantial, but all our actions are consequential. What we experience is in harmony with the laws of nature. There's conditionality in this world, there's interconnection, there's relatedness. So they say that when we are perceiving like the insubstantiality, the fleeting nature of everything, we would say emptiness, we grow in wisdom. And when we perceive relatedness, the way actions have consequences, when we perceive the interconnection of life, we grow in love. And one never excludes the other. We have, just like, you know, they always use the example of the two wings of a bird. We have the ability to let go, to see through, to not cling, to start anew, that's born of wisdom. And we have the ability to really find meaningfulness in our lives through connection, through caring, through loving kindness. And that is a much deeper sense of the middle way. And I say this as I'm sure, you know, anyone who's familiar with my work knows that most of those 13 books have been about loving kindness. Maybe they've all been about loving kindness. And even Kind Carl, which is my first children's book coming out in December, is about Carl, the crocodile, learning kindness. And there are all these exercises in the back of loving kindness and gratitude and things for children and families. And so, especially in a time where there are different ways of describing it, we could say we're living in rising tides of hatred, which I think is true. We're also living in a time of a lot of nihilism and feeling that whatever we might do or care about, our families, friendships, you know, the world, the culture, couldn't possibly mean anything. You know, I think it's really important to investigate for ourselves, like, how all of this can exist. You know, the transparency of things, the movement, the endless movement of things, and also that what we do matters and what we care about matters, and really uphold this sense of the possibility of loving kindness.